Thank you. Well, welcome to the March 18, 2010 Senate meeting. We're very pleased you took time to be here. We have a few interesting items for your consideration. And let's start first with the informational item. And we have with us Vice President Mary Otto for outreach, and she has for us a presentation and then some remarks. Mary?
Good afternoon, everyone. It's really good to see everyone. I love what I'm doing, but I miss seeing everyone. I really do. So you all need to come out to my side of town and see me. And some of you have. We have nice, comfortable space out there in the other side of the world. It's really only 18 miles. However, I met with the Senate last year, and there were a couple things that came up that we wanted to get back to you on. And then I want to talk to you about a couple of things we're doing that we think are really important for the university. One is that when we heard from all of you a year ago that one of the things that would make it a lot better for teaching at the University Center would be to have smart desks. And so we said, fine, we thought we could do that, and we did. And we now have three smart desks that are portable that can go into any of the classrooms. So if you're teaching in a classroom that is not up to date with technology, we can at least get you a reasonable flow of technology through the smart desks. And the nicest thing about doing this is that not only did you ask for it, but the faculty actually used them. And so we get a lot of use out of them. And that's because that's always one of the things that makes me nervous. We buy things, spend money on them, and then we say, nobody's using them. And that hasn't happened. We can tell you that we've had lots of use of the smart desks, and I think that's very helpful. The other thing that was brought up, there were no complaints about parking there. That was good. So nothing to report there. But there was a concern about food was the other issue. As in, there is none anywhere. So we will be starting this spring with food carts, actually a food cart that will service UC2. And I think there may end up being one in UC3 as well. And the food cart, of course, will have mostly sandwiches and junk food, but it will be food and pop and water and those types of things. We're looking at a time frame of something like 4 to 8:30. We're still kind of negotiating that around how long we need to have it open so that we can get through breaks and all of that. But I'm guessing that we will be closing, it will probably be closing about 8:30. So those of you who are teaching in the evening, we'll let you know the hours for sure so you can try to get your break in before we close down the food cart. So that's a couple of things we've done, and of course, we're eager to hear from you again. What else can we do to make teaching at Macomb comfortable and easy? We want to facilitate that as much as we can. One of the things that we have really been working on, and there's in your packet of information, there's a sheet that called dual admission and concurrent enrollment programs. I think that most of you know that community college enrollments are literally through the top of the ceiling right now. We know pretty much that because of the economy, many people feel like they need to make the cost of a college education as reasonable as possible. And one of the things that has happened is that many people now are starting at a community college. You know that we have the M2O program, and I'm going to actually share with you this afternoon a video. And normally I think, oh, that puts people to sleep, but I'm sharing this one with you because we didn't do it. Our students did. And I think they did a great job. I hope you agree. But this idea was developed by students. The students did the work. They put it together because they really like M2O. They think it's great for them. So I'm going to share that. It's about a 7-minute video. But what I wanted to share with you is that we're trying to do more and more of that. So We have been working with Oakland Community College, which I know many people think should have been first, but it's going to be second. And we are in the process of, I think, we've got great teams of people working really hard to pull together a program with OCC and with SC4, better known as St. Clair Community College. So we should be able to sign memorandums of understanding, agreements to move forward with those. And what that means, basically, is that students are duly admitted to Oakland University. They meet all the requirements of being admitted to the university. At the same time, they're admitted to the community college. We think the advantage of that is that students who say often, I intend to go to the community college and then transfer. But this gets them right in the door from the get-go. Like, there's no decision, sort of. There's not a point where they have to decide, am I or am I not going to transfer? Because in this program, all of the paperwork is done so that they are automatically moved right through to their bachelor's degree. And, in fact, the students in this program do end up with 2 degrees, both an associate's degree and a bachelor's degree. We think that even though we've got large numbers of transfer students from these institutions, that this will help us as well as them because it will help us to have some of the better students persist into our university. And we believe this will really increase the number of students who will persist to graduation. We don't know that yet because we have not been in this business long enough to really collect data. We've had big groups of people graduate who started, but it's such a small sample because when we started out, we were doing 5 and 10 and 25. Now I think we have about, I don't know, Pam, what is it, 500 or 600 students in the cohort for M2O?
Yeah, 540.
That's much more exact than my numbers. And we expect that we will have a large enrollment next fall. So we think this is an important thing for Oakland University. We think this is it's important for Oakland University to work, to partner, to collaborate with community colleges, and to collaborate with the communities to say, we want to hear what it is that we can do to make it easier for the students in your geography to persist and to get through to college. Because none of us really know for sure. There's a lot of talk about what the new economy will be like after the recession. And so there's a lot of guesses, and none of us know for sure. But one thing we do know for sure, and that is that education is really incredibly important to that future. So the more that we can make it easy for students to get a college education, I think that we provide a wonderful service not only to our students, but to the state. And hopefully, even more people. So I'm going to now have, hopefully George is going to play the video for you, and then I will be happy to answer any of your questions.
M2O Oakland, or M2O, is an innovative partnership between Oakland University and Macomb Community College to bring degree program options directly to the residents of Macomb County through the state's first joint admission and concurrent enrollment program. This program is designed to help move students toward completion of their bachelor's degree more quickly and to help ease the burden of college costs. With one application, students apply to both institutions and take advantage of the resources offered by both schools.
My major is engineering chemistry. My name is Michael Kirk.
Erica Okerholm. I am an undecided.
My name is Krista Vanstein-Kissey, and I am an elementary education student.
Shaw Mueller, and my major is communications.
I decided to become an M2O student mainly because I knew I could take classes at Macomb and transfer them to Oakland.
I figured it would just be easier to transition into Oakland University from Macomb. You don't have to send in transcripts or anything like that.
I decided to become an M2O student because of the money that I can save.
The M2O program offers students many benefits, including a more affordable education. A student will save more than $14,000 when compared to the cost of a traditional four-year degree.
I'm definitely saving money being an M2O student. To be able to transfer over credits from Macomb saves me thousands of dollars.
I don't want to be in too much debt later, so I decided to go to Macomb.
I'm saving a ton of money. It's really nice, you know, especially if you can't get financial help or, you know, your parents aren't helping you out.
Taking one class at Macomb and three at Oakland saves me almost $1,000.
Students enjoy the small class sizes offered at OU and Macomb. OU's average class size is 19 students, while Macomb typically has 20 to 25 students per class.
The English classes I've taken there were, you know, like a maybe like 30 people.
At Macomb, I think I have 20, 30 students in my classes.
I love, you know, the closeness, you know, having like the smaller classes. I learn a lot better being, you know, like hands-on and, you know, having the one-on-one instead of, like, the lectures.
I really like my professors. They treat you as adults and individuals, and they really help you with any problems that you have, and they're willing to meet with you during their office hours or whenever they need to go over tests or questions that you have.
The M2O program provides joint admission through one application, as well as concurrent enrollment at OU and Macomb, offering the flexibility to take courses at one or both institutions at the same time.
One semester, you can be entirely at Macomb. Another semester, you can be entirely at Oakland. So it just creates great flexibility, and it also gives the opportunity to complete degrees at both schools as well.
The scheduling is really flexible. It's actually nice to have the scheduling like far apart. You know, you can schedule your Oakland classes sooner, and you can do like the Monday, Wednesday, Friday classes with one school. And the Macomb classes, you schedule them a little bit later.
Essentially, I was able to take three classes at Oakland on Tuesday and Thursday, so I just spend my whole day at Oakland, and then I took one class on Friday. So essentially, I save a ton of gas money, along with just being able to take classes pretty much whenever I want.
The location for me, it's closer than going all the way out to Rochester.
You can switch it up, be at one school, you know, one whole day, and the next day you're at the different school. So it's nice to have that flexibility and, you know, switched up a little bit.
M2O also has coordinated financial aid, advising, and course planning at both institutions while offering an expanded course selection with greater flexibility.
Their financial aid is coordinated through Oakland, but it's a unique program in that the financial aid can be used at both schools.
So they get academic advising advice from both Macomb Community College and Oakland University advisors to make sure that the courses that they're taking will indeed transfer.
I've talked to two advisors, Cheryl and Andrea, and they both helped me out a lot.
I remember coming to the OU building and then meeting with an advisor, and I brought them my Macomb transcripts. They sat me down, told me what credits transfer for what, and what else I'm going to have to take at Macomb and at OU in order to graduate.
And Andrea has talked about the elementary education program and went through with me what classes I can and cannot take at Macomb and what classes I have to take at Oakland. And they really helped me to make a set plan.
And I knew going into each semester what I was going to have to register for, what classes. If I didn't get those classes, what were my options outside of that, and they just made it very easy for me.
Another benefit for M2O students is access to the on-campus resources at both institutions, including OU housing, student activities, and athletic events.
They are able to live on campus at Oakland University while being part of this program. Some students aren't sure that you're able to do that.
An M2O student would be able to access resources at both schools. So they would be able to access counseling and advising, career services, the Learning Center.
I enjoy taking summer classes at both Oakland and Macomb because they're quicker, more compact.
I like being able to be at the university, to have the feel of a big campus and have lunch on campus and have all like the activities going on, but then you're not stuck at school all day, so it's nice to have each day be a little bit different.
Students in the M2O program receive a timely completion of associate's and bachelor's degrees.
Honestly, this experience has gone by so fast. It's only been 2 years and I'm already graduating from my bachelor's degree.
The M2O program offers students a quality education at an affordable price. Students can apply to become an M2O student at oakland.edu/M2O.
I think that hearing it from the students is pretty clear. They like it because it really reaches out to them and it's really convenient. Probably the best thing about the CC to OU programs is that it's really totally for the benefit of the students. I don't know that the institutions really gain anything more than they would in a typical transfer program, maybe, but what we are clear about is that students are really happy with the opportunity to do this. And after all, that is sort of what we're about, is making sure that we increase the access for students and make it easier for them. I do have another handout that I will leave for people to pick up if they're interested, because many of you already have the information. But I also have some information on the incentive program model, so that those of you who do not have programs at Macomb, we're always interested in working with you to develop a program. So I will leave a copy of the information on the incentive program so that you can take a look, so you can see what it's about. And certainly I encourage you, give us a call. I handed out a sheet that has all of us listed. Give us a call, come out and see us, take a look. If you haven't been out yet, we'd be happy to have you come out. We're happy to have your whole faculty come out. If you want to have a staff meeting or something, we're happy to have you come out and take a look at what we're doing. So with that, any questions, comments, thoughts? Yes.
Yes, for the record. Thank you.
Tom Jones. Yeah. Education Human Services. Good to see you, Mary.
Yeah, thank you. Good
I
to see you.
I enjoyed the video, and I teach over at MUC, and it's very comfortable there. The resources are good. A quick question about the very end of the video. Was the student speaking about an entire bachelor's degree in 2 years, or was that just the post-associate's part?
I think, I'm not sure, but I think just the post-associate's part.
That would be more comfortable. If it's the other,
I think they were thinking about that the issues with the transfer in the past, that what we've been able to do with M2O is to really get not just course-to-course articulation, but program articulation, so that when people start in a program like elementary ed, it doesn't take them any longer than it would if they were on campus. They can't really do elementary ed in 4 years, but they can't do it here in 4 years either. So I think what the students are talking about is that they really get kind of their whole 2 years, because that was a big complaint of the traditional transfer model, is that most students felt like they were ending up really adding an extra year often. So we've pretty much, through these transfer models, diminished that.
That's good. Thank you.
Well, Mary, thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate that. Those of you who are considering, as Dr. Otto mentioned, incentive programs, if you are interested, please work through your dean. That's where the academic units operate those programs, and I think there's a lot of helpful information and resource development within the units by examining those options. Thank you. We are able to go on to roll call.
Good afternoon. Susan Aubrey. Pete Bertocci. Keith Bourbon. Louie Shamra. Vivian Chen. Edith Chopin. Brian Connery. Mark Doman. Andrea Ice. Theo English, Bob Folberg, Donna Free, Frank Giblin, Annie Gilson, Kevin Grimm, Jerry Grossman, Layla Gassous, Suba Hanif, Derek Hastings, Ken Hightower, Jeff Insko, Oded Israeli, Francis Jackson, Bill Keen, John Kim, Serge Crook, Tim Larrabee, Mike Latcha, Todd Leibert, Tom Lamarb, Paul Licker, Barbara Mabee, Charles Marks, Jay Meehan, Fatma Millie, Karen Miller,
here.
Ken Mitten, Sean Moran, Annette Osborne,
here.
Tom Pedroni,
here.
Barb Penpraise, Michelle Piskulich,
here.
Cheryl Riley Doucette, Joel Russell,
here.
Linda Schweitzer,
here.
Laura Sharpman, Michelle Southward, Anna Spagnolo, Ron Sudol, Ann Switzer, Emily Tissot, Ron Tracy, Julie Volk, Julie Walters, Karen Wells is here, and Lynn Williams. Thanks so much.
Thank you. We move on to item C, which is the approval of the minutes of February 11th meeting. Is there someone to make the motion? We approve the minutes.
So moved.
Thank you. And second, Paul Licker.
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion, amendments? Paul?
I hope this is technical, but if you read the first big paragraph, there's $62 million missing. $40 and $22 and $2.70 don't add up.
Thank you. Only a person from business administration will note it, and thank you. Very important. Thank you. We will make the due amendment. Any other? If not, with the change suggested by our colleague Paul Licker, please indicate your approval by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? So approved. Thank you. We move to item D, which is an old business, which is a motion, and Professor Osborne and Mr. Lacha will propose the motion. This is the second reading. It had been proposed and seconded, but Mike, if you want to restate for us the motion.
Moved that the Senate recommend to the President and the Board of Trustees approval of the new Constitution of the School of Education and Human Services.
Thank you. It has been seconded earlier, but we'll welcome another second. Yes, thank you, Tim. Any discussion? And to present is with us our colleague, Jim Chablowski, so I'll give you the salient feature of this marvelous document. Jim?
Well, one of the purpose of this is to bring current practice into line with the constitution of the school. I mentioned the last time that when we had brought it forward last year, we did not realize that we were working with a copy of the old constitution that was not consistent with the one that was held in the general counsel's office. So that's been corrected. millions of formatting issues, which I don't want to really get into. The issue of whether or not they have student representation, which we have added back into the Constitution, and the representation for the staff of the school on items that were non-academic in nature. While I don't like talking about formatting and those type of things, on section 1.5, there is an error that should be corrected, which is interesting. It was in the old one. But it says that the administrative instructional unit within school, after seeking advice or counsel of, and that should be the advice and counsel of. So I would ask your permission to change that or to and, if that would be within your purview. There are several other places where spaces need to be inserted between paragraphs, but I know that on this form that you have, it would be very hard to tell that since the PDFs cut it up quite a bit. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I call on the senators to make those adjustments in their understanding as they vote. I think these are minor adjustments that Jim has suggested, which could be made in the final document. Ron, do you have a comment?
No.
Okay. Any other thoughts or comments or suggestions? I assume, Jim, all the changes suggested have been made?
I have them marked on my copy here, right. And since I am the keeper of the copies for the school at this point, then yes, they will be made.
Thank you. Hearing none, let's vote on this. Is the second reading?
Kevin?
One quick question.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Come on, thanks. Thanks, Jim. And just double checking, under 3.6, Article 3.6, the new language says the dean shall present the proposed agenda for the assembly, and so forth. Was the deletion of or designee quite deliberate and considered? I mean, that language was there in the original language. I'm just wondering if that was the intent to.
Yes, it is the intent that the dean would present. The dean is, in another section, you'll notice that the dean is advised by the executive committee as to the agenda. So it's the responsibility lies within the dean's office and consequently the dean.
And ruling out the option of the dean designating a.
Yes, I would think so.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other comments? If not, let's vote on. This is second reading. All those in favor of approval of this constitution with the amendments and small changes suggested by the proponent, please indicate your approval by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? So approved. Congratulations, Jim.
And I thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Second item is a resolution supporting a statement on academic freedom, and Mr. Grimm and Mr. Lachow had proposed this as second reading as well. Kevin, would you kindly do this again for us?
Yes, move that the Senate supports a statement on academic freedom at Oakland University.
Thank you. And we assume Mr. Lachow second, is it?
Yes.
All right, thank you. Any comments, suggestions? An important, yes. Kevin, Ken Mitten.
I think I emailed Mike already. Did you get my email? Yeah, there was like a committee reference still in the document that refers to a University of Michigan committee. Oh, okay, that one's out.
Okay, good.
Thank you. This is also a second reading, which means we can vote. If you have no additional comments or thoughts or suggestion amendments, let's vote. Please indicate your approval by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? So approved. Congratulations. We move to item, yes, Dr. Russell.
Do you intend to take this statement to the Board of Trustees and ask their endorsement?
If this is the Senate's pleasure and directive to me, I'll be happy to. Anything that goes here is communicated to the president and the board.
Would it be appropriate to make a motion to ask you to do that?
If you so please.
And I would like to move that the Senate directs the provost to bring this statement to the Board of Trustees and ask for their endorsement.
Second.
Any comments, thoughts? All those in favor of the idea or the motion that this recently approved item be presented through me to the President and the Board of Trustees, please indicate your approval by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Abstentions? We shall do that. Thank you. New business is a motion from the Steering Committee to recommend approval of the Clinical Nurse Leader Program in the School of Nursing. And Professor Jackson was to make the motion.
I have two motions. I move that the Senate recommend to the President and the Board of Trustees approval of a program leading to the Master of Science degree in Nursing Clinical Nurse Leadership.
Second. Thank you.
Second motion, that we waive the second reading. You want me to wait on that till you discuss it?
Jerry, please help us with that.
Well, we should probably have some discussion first.
Yeah. Let's have some discussion and then consider, according to our parliamentarian, whether that is a possibility. Yes. Dean Julie Volk.
I'm the Dean of the Library, Julie Volk. I'm pretty sure this is an oversight because I know that the School of Nursing values the access to library materials highly, particularly electronic journals. But in the budget for the program, there is nothing in the line for the library.
Well, Julie, thank you for bringing it up. What we have is a Professor Marissa Ferrari here to present this program for us, for the senators, and then I think this would be an appropriate question for her. Thank you.
This was actually something that was caught by Senate budget and added, and this must not be, because it certainly was and certainly was included. So I think that this must not be the most current document, because that was something that budget had originally caught.
I think if you could, in your presentation, indicate that where that support is available, that might satisfy Dean Volk's comment.
Okay.
Thank you.
I don't have that, unfortunately. This program is a new program that was brought by the American Association of the Colleges of Nursing, and it was created to improve the quality of patient care and to improve their outcomes. And the white paper position statement is found at the AACN website. The groundwork, they included the Institute of Medicine, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the American Hospital Association, and the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations. They also consulted with the American Organization of Nursing Executives, the Plexus Institute at the University of Kansas School of Nursing, and the American Nurse Association. They also had 15 representatives from the State Board of Nursing. The rationale for the degree is that the clinical nurse leader is someone who provides care coordination in complex situations. This is somebody who applies clinical research so that patients benefit from the latest innovations in the care delivery. This person evaluates patient outcomes, assesses cohort risks. They have the decision-making authority to change care when necessary, and they provide leadership to the unit. This is a 44-credit master's program. 16 of those credits can also be in a certificate program, and then you can just see how it falls in with the other School of Nursing master's programs that we currently have. The students are required to complete 400 clinical hours, and this is done at with various leaders in the healthcare organizations. And at the completion, they are eligible to complete to take the Commission on Nursing Certification exam and become certified as a clinical nurse leader. The foundation courses are the same courses that we offer to all of our current masters in nursing program. So these students would just fall into those foundation courses Similarly, the clinical core courses are the same, and these students would be taking the same courses as our other master's nursing students. This is where we differ, our specialty courses and the post-MSN certificate courses. The courses are in nursing leadership, clinical outcomes management, a care environment management, and then a mentored clinical experience. And then I just have a plan of study for 2, 3, and 4 year, which is also included in the proposal. And lastly, there are no new courses. There are only 4 new courses to the program, and so the current faculty would be teaching these. We have 1 PhD eligible, qualified rather, 2 DNP, and 1 master's nurse who is currently in his PhD program who would be eligible. The library, in response to your question, I have to pull my other folder. I'm sorry. And I don't know how that is missing. But we did query the library. We did get a budget from them, and it was additionally added after the Senate budget came back with the same comment that it was not in their line. And I apologize. It's going to take me a second to find it, though. Thank you. That helps. Oh, okay. Yeah. And so the... Thank you. So the total for the library report was the first year, $6,000, the second year, $6,450, the third year, $6,935, fourth, $7,456, and the fifth year, $8,018. And that should have been included into the budget after the Senate budget had approved that with that addition. I apologize for missing that.
Has any of this transaction occurred, Julie? The expected amount?
No, because we have to wait for the program to be approved.
Okay.
Is there any other questions that I can? Yeah. The enrollment is, we're anticipating about an additional 15 students, you know, once the program's up and running, which would basically require one faculty to teach this additional course. The question is kind of twofold, because with more leaders out in the organization, we have more, you know, clinical opportunities, which is really where we're struggling with our faculty. Of course, we're struggling with the didactic as well. I mean, there's just not enough of us. But that'll increase our clinical opportunities in the hospitals. So it will, you know, it may take one faculty to teach those classes, but it will also provide that clinical resource once they've graduated to our students who are, you know, who would be coming forth as a bachelor's student.
Any additional comments? Jay, Professor Meehan.
This may not be for you to answer, but I was noting that the Budget Review Committee endorsed this and said that their minor concerns have been satisfactorily addressed. And I'm comparing the Budget Review Committee for the two proposals before us today. And the second one, there's a question about whether or not the dean has indicated that they would support the program. This is in the one coming up, should it fall into financial difficulty. So I'm wondering if the Budget Committee asked the dean of the School of Nursing to supply a similar assurance that should this program fall into difficulty. I don't believe it will. It doesn't look like it from what I'm reading. But do you know if they did, or would someone here from the Budget Committee be able to answer that? That's what I'm saying. It's not. I don't think it's your question.
If it was not contained in the original proposal, we did, and we were satisfied, yes.
I see. So you're satisfied, so the question wasn't asked of the dean to assure that if this program falls into
the
difficulty.
The question was asked and answered satisfactorily,
and it was answered.
Yes.
Got it. Did they provide a letter?
Yes.
Perfect.
Yes, Dr. Jackson.
Yeah, and I'd also like to point out, I don't know what version you have, but we do have a query from the VA hospital system to do all of their CNOs. So they would be sending from around the country, sending figuratively their postmaster students for this for the program.
That's correct. And all of the VA nurses need to be CNL certified.
Right.
By 2016. So there is an industry demand for the program.
There's industry demand, and there's a pipeline straight to Oakland University.
Mm-hmm.
One of the major VA hospitals in the country is Dr. Ruby Wesley, who was an adjunct faculty member for us, has committed all of their CNLs to come to Oakland.
Any additional comments or questions? If not, we will take a look at approving the program and then move on to this waiving the second reading, correct?
Well, I think now is the appropriate time to move to waive the second reading.
Okay. Accordingly, the proposal was made that we waive the second reading for this program. Those in favor of...
I move we waive the second reading.
It needs a second discussion and three-quarters vote.
Meehan, second. Discussion, comments, objections, support. And for waiving the second reading, we need three-quarters of the membership. So we may have to show hands and work with that. All those support of waiving the second reading, please indicate your approval by showing hands. Thank you. All those who believe we should not waive the second reading, please indicate your dissatisfaction by raising hands. None. So we have approved we waive the second reading. Now we're coming to the original proposal about the program. Any discussion, comments, additional thoughts? Dr. Ferrari, the budget issue will be incorporated into the final product.
Yes, I'll make sure.
And if this is a reminder to anyone proposing a new program, it is your responsibility as a proposer to submit to me, the secretary, the final version of your program after it's gone through review.
Thank you. With that, we are ready to, Dean Volk, are you satisfied with this adjustment in the budget? Thank you. Let's vote then. Those in favor of approving this program, please indicate approval by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? So approved. Congratulations. Thank you. We move on to the item number two from the new program, new items. There's a motion from the steering committee, and Professor Green will make the motion.
Move that the Senate recommend to the President and the Board of Trustees approval of a program leading to the Master of Arts in Communication.
Thank you. I think there are some presentations from Professor Jen Heisler and Lily Mendoza.
You should probably have a second first.
Second.
Second. Thank you.
As the cover page indicates, this proposal comes from the College of Arts and Sciences. It was approved by the college, and I'm bringing it on behalf of the college to the Senate.
Thank you.
This is a proposal to offer a master's degree, MA in communication. This is a very large major currently. It's a faculty that has grown exponentially because of tremendous growth in student enrollments in the undergraduate program. And the quality of the faculty that's been developed and the number of students that are seen to be potential for being a part of a master's program is such that we feel comfortable in bringing this program forward. It's also a relatively inexpensive program. It doesn't require labs or complicated things like that, so the budget is very reasonable. Jennifer Heisler is the chair of the department, and she is backed up today by a small army of members of the department, too numerous to name, but they're all over this room. And so I'll turn it over to Jen.
Thank you, Dean Sudol, for your supportive comments. And thank you to my numerous faculty members who have made the trek out here to support our program. I thought we would start today just with a little bit of the background so you could understand why now, where did this come from? This is a brand new idea. I've been here at Oakland approximately 8 or 9 years now, and I have to say that when I interviewed for the position, the folks there were talking, hinting about a master's program. Now, we were nowhere ready to build that program at that time, but I wanted you to know that this is not a new idea in the department. This is something that has been culminating for several years across many faculty members. But what changed? Why would we start this now? One of the biggest changes in our department is the additional faculty members we were able to secure in the last year, particularly those experienced with master's programs. We've had some wonderful new hires that come from programs where they've either had master's programs or that they, in one case, even led a master's program, served as the director of that program. Also, at the same time, we see sort of a terrible perfect storm in present-day Michigan. We see more and more students who are forced to come back to the university, retool themselves, get themselves ready for different job, different opportunities that they might have. Many of them are unemployed and seeking a brand new career. And with those ideas, we've found that our master's proposal falls in line with the university's goals and programs, such that master's programs will meet the needs of Michigan students. And I certainly think that a master's program in communication might offer that to students, as well as an ability to advance the knowledge for those folks who need to come back and get ready for a new adventure in their career. Some of the program basics you might like to know about. We're hoping to get this off the ground and have our first classes in enrollment start this fall. The program is broken up into three areas of concentration. We'll have an interpersonal communication area, critical cultural studies, and a media studies program. These areas were developed with our faculty expertise in mind. We have faculty members currently able to teach in all these areas. In fact, we have multiple faculty members that could handle classes in each of these areas. We also are aware and mindful of what our students will be wanting from us, and we're aware that some of our students will want to continue on with their doctoral studies. We feel that that program will prepare those students well for that, as well as some folks seeking a terminal degree. Now, those students might go on to teach perhaps at the community college level, or in many cases be professionals seeking to enhance their current marketability in Michigan's economy. So we're aware that we will both be serving folks continuing on in their degree as well as folks who just are seeking the master's program as a terminal program. We're hoping to offer all of our students kind of a broad scope of our field. This is the basic framework we have for the course offerings. And we have a handout that would offer the details. I believe that you have many of those, but this is kind of a condensed version. Yeah. In summary, you'll see that we're asking our students to take about 32 credits of coursework. Among those includes two core classes. Those would be the Intro to Grad Studies classes, as well as a Philosophy of Communication course, serves sort of as a history to the discipline. We're asking our students to take one of two methods classes, either a qualitative research or a quantitative research. They'll take three courses in their area of expertise or concentration. So for instance, if I'm an interpersonal scholar, I would take three courses in interpersonal. Media studies would do three courses in media studies. But then also, because we understand that our students need a breadth of knowledge as well as depth, we're asking our students to take two elective courses. These would serve in areas outside of their concentration. For instance, an interpersonal scholar might also like to take a media studies class. In addition to these 32 credits, we are asking, obviously, for the exit course to occur. This exit course would be 4 credits and would either be the thesis or the exams or a creative project. And with that, we're thinking of some students in the media studies area, their final project could be a documentary, some kind of broadcast presentation. So we wanted to leave room for the students that would be seeking knowledge in that area. How are we sure that this program will work for us? Well, for one, we're offering an interesting program that other schools in the area don't offer. We're the only program in this area, in Michigan, that offers a focus on critical cultural studies that makes it unique from any other master's in communication in the entire state, as well as our ability to offer a range of methodologies. We have faculty in our department that are schooled both in the qualitative methods, such as ethnography, as well as quantitative methods. And so our students would be able to take either class and actually focus on a particular kind of methodology. We're hoping for some strong enrollment. You'll see that part of our success is based on our ability to admit both full-time students as well as part-time. And in spite of no advertisement, really, this has just been a little bit of word of mouth from our students saying, when's the master's program going to debut? We haven't done any formal advertising. And it's our understanding that the graduate school has received over 30 inquiries into the program already. Students are asking, when is this going to happen? And it's not just anecdotal. We actually have a list of student names in the graduate school. They're waiting for us to seek approval. Obviously, part of our viability will depend upon our budget. For budget planning, we're expecting about 25 students in the first year. I think that's fairly realistic given the list of 30 names we've got already without any advertisement. We're expecting by 2015 that would increase about 50%. So in 5 years, approximately 50 students would be enrolled. We're expecting both a mix of full-time and part-time students, as well as budgeting for faculty. We've made sure that in the first year of the program, we would need no additional faculty members. We've got class coverage for both our undergraduate as well as our master's program in the first year without any desperate need of faculty. However, by the second year, as the program increases in number, we're probably expecting to need an additional faculty member in year two, the second year of the program, and then possibly another additional faculty member by year four. We also wanted to make sure that none of our undergraduate classes would suffer as a result of the new classes in the master's program. And we've managed to take very close look at that and take care that all our undergraduate offerings should be able to be offered, and we shouldn't see a reduction in any of those courses. For assistantships, we would hope for at least 2 graduate assistants in the first year and then possibly doubling that, increasing ever more as possible. And it's important to note the flip side of the course offers you our budget pro forma, and you'll see that we're hoping for a profitable, financially profitable program by year 3. We've had a lot of help and a lot of support with this program. There's been several fellow departments that have offered their written and verbal support. These are just a few. The Graduate Council, we've been through all the Senate budget review, planning, and assessment, and many of them have offered many words of advice, but as well as their recommendations. In fact, we were pleased to see that in one case we actually had no changes to make, which was wonderful. One of the important questions in our program is, how are you going to assess it? How are you going to be sure that you are doing what you say you're doing? One of the goals we have for our program in the larger packet is advanced training for our students in communication. Regardless of their end goal, whether it's a terminal degree or continued study, we want to be sure that they have a depth and a breadth of communication in our discipline. We've designed classes to emphasize analytical skills as well as beefing up their written skills, and it culminates in their final project, and we've tried to offer enough option for those students who would seek perhaps the creative project versus the standard thesis. We have exit interviews planned, as well as their portfolio evaluation. And by portfolio, I mean that final project. So whatever they choose to do, whether it be a thesis or a creative project or exams, that's what we mean by portfolio evaluation. So we're very excited to be here, and we're interested in hearing your thoughts and comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments, thoughts? Leila Gusu?
I apologize, I have laryngitis, but I'm just wondering about the first course, Introduction to Graduate Studies. The title sounds extremely generic, and so I just wanted to know what that was about, and I don't know if you consider the different title for it to make it sound more targeted to communication.
I believe that the intro to grad studies would be suitable probably for master's students in communication, so we could add the title intro to communication grad studies. We expect that many of our students will come to the program without any idea of what to expect in a master's program. So this course seeks to orient them to both the different disciplines that we represent. For instance, we have someone who does critical cultural studies, someone who does media, and many of our students won't know the breadth, and so they'll need that. But they'll also need to know what is a literature review, you know, where is the library, and basic graduate success, both for comm students but outside the comm discipline as well. Also, it's a chance for them to get to know our different faculty members, as well as not just an overview of our program, but real... we want to ensure their success in the master's program, and we feel like an orientation class like that will offer some of those things to them.
I mean, we've had like orientation classes, introduction to engineering, but usually it wouldn't be 4 credits. So, I mean, if it was more like, if you said, fundamentals of communication or introduction to research methodologies or something like that, I think it, if I were, for instance, someone evaluating a student's transcript, I would look at that title and, you know, again, I'm sure you know what exactly what you have in mind for that, but the title just does not sound graduate enough, at least in my opinion, so.
Dr. Meehan has a point that would come. Please.
If you look in the original proposal versus what's on this short sheet, it says Introduction to Graduate Studies in Communication. Mm-hmm. It actually gives a listing of, it's going to be an overview of the field of communication, et cetera, which may address what you're talking about from a title standpoint. But it is Graduate Studies in Communication, not just generic. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Graduate. So, and I believe the original syllabus is part of that too. Thank you.
Dr. Licker?
I have 2 questions to ask you about this program. I'll start with the second one, actually. The first year, you're going to have 4 new courses. But in the second year, you're going to have 13 new courses. Mm-hmm. Are you prepared for that?
Yes.
Can you share your knowledge and hints with everybody else in the room here? That's an awful lot of new courses.
Mm-hmm. In the first year, I'm assuming you're asking sort of about faculty coverage. Yes. The area of communication has probably seen some of the same enrollment struggles that you folks have in your undergraduate courses. We have some that are thriving and some that are not. In our department, we've found over the course of time that some of our 400 level classes, we don't have many, but some of our 400 level classes have not been reaching the enrollment that we'd like to see. And especially some of our special topics courses, those courses that you float out there with the hopes that students will grab hold and we can develop them into permanent courses. And that's where we've seen our enrollment struggles. So as a result, in order to balance our communication undergrad offerings with our graduate school offerings, we've planned to reduce the number of 400-level courses, particularly those that aren't making anyway, and limit our numbers of special topics. Now, we still have special topics courses available for our undergrads, but instead of choosing from 5, they'll get to choose from 3. And so in that way, we're switching a little bit of the undergrad focus on special topics and 400 levels, that frees up some of our faculty members to teach the graduate courses. We've done it specifically so that we only need two additional grad classes in the fall, and then two or possibly three, depending on enrollment in the grad program, classes in the winter, which again should take one faculty member and one faculty member. And we believe that with the freeing up of those folks who would typically teach the special topics classes number 4 and 5 and 6, or the 400 level classes that aren't currently making in our undergrad enrollment, that that would allow us to offer grad classes without substantially changing our undergrad offerings. Then by the second year, when we double that and we need to also provide new classes for our ongoing students as well as those introductory courses again, that's where we really see the pressure to hire, finally in our second year, a brand new faculty member who could help with the course coverage of the master's program so that we don't any further diminish our undergrad offerings.
Dr. Laker, please continue.
Well, that brings up a third question, but let me go back to the first one that I didn't ask. Who is this program intended for? Is this program intended to bring people into the field of communication who have not had a background in it before? Mm-hmm. In which case, one might wonder why one course would do the trick and then immediately into a concentration which ignores the huge breadth of the field. Mm-hmm. Having spent many years teaching in such a program myself, I don't understand how someone could have one four-credit course and then move in, basically, other than methodology and philosophy, move into a specialization. And then, as long as I'm standing up, I may as well optimize my traveling back and forth and ask you, in the third year of the program, everybody's going to have to be doing an exam or a project or a thesis, and that means you're going to have 25 students in the third year of your program, 35 the next year, and 45 students, most of whom won't want to do an exam and will be doing probably projects and theses mostly projects, I imagine, if my experience is any still current. That's an awful lot of projects.
I'll answer the second question first. It's fresh in my mind. As for the third year, because it is a two-year program, we would love it if 25 of our students made it through in 2 years. But we're realistic, perhaps pessimistic. Realists, we'll say we're realists, and we realize that first of all, many of our students will be coming part-time, and if they're coming part-time, then obviously that delays that final project or their portfolio. They wouldn't be able. So say half of our students are coming part-time. That reduces the number to, say, 12 or 13. Of 12 and 13 students, we're assuming all of them have absolutely no difficulties with any courses and are able to complete at the same time. And of those, we recognize that some of our students, and this is a little bit of the answer to question number one, some of our students will be coming in as terminals. And we expect that those folks who are seeking professional enhancement, those folks who want to get a taste of this to better themselves in Michigan's environment, those folks will probably choose comprehensive exams. And we're expecting approximately half, if not more than half, of our intro classes, introductory students, would seek that option. So we're at 13 now, we're perhaps down to 7 or 8 or maybe even 9 students taking exams. While we're offering the option, and we would encourage the option of our students to seek advanced degrees at doctoral programs, we recognize that, at least in the beginning, that really a smaller portion of our students will be going on to doctoral programs, not the greater number. And so we feel that the faculty of the students who perhaps are ready to graduate and do theses or do creative projects might be number closer to 4 or 5, maybe 6, if we're really lucky and real fortunate. But we feel ready to handle theses projects for that number of students. The original question, I believe, was, would one class be able to cover the large breadth of communication? No. That's why we're offering two. We have both an intro to grad studies, which is offered as kind of a, yes, an overview, but also a manner of success. How do you become a successful graduate student? How do you get through your master's program well? What skills do you need, both in com but outside? In addition to that, we have the other 4-credit class, which is called Philosophy of Communication, and that offers a historical approach to our field, an entire semester's worth of comm history, if you will. And we have folks that are schooled in Aristotle and eager to teach a historical class. And we imagine that those students would get an entire semester's worth of where do you fit in. Now, some of our students will come from Oakland and some of them will come from outside. We expect, in fact, many of our initial class to come from terminal bachelor's degrees from our program. It's many of the inquiries are coming from our students. And then we hope to pull in those outside. I imagine that it'll, again, be a smaller percentage of those coming, say, from English into comm as a master's program.
Dr. Pedroni, then Dr. Grossman.
Tom Pedroni, School of Education and Human Services. And I guess I need to apologize. As someone who's new to the Senate this year, I'm not sure what sort of questions are inbound, the ones we're supposed to visit as a faculty Senate in relation to a proposal, and what aren't. I'll let you know what my question is about, and then you can tell me if it's, you know, not in our purview. But my question is about the qualitative versus the quantitative course. And if this isn't within our purview, then I'll just make it a matter of intellectual curiosity or something. I say this as someone who's taught methods, research methods courses. How do students decide if they want to take a qualitative or take a quantitative course? I mean, for me, one of the main questions that, if I were the advisor, would be to say to the student, well, what sort of research questions are you asking, and are you building a study, and what sort of methods would be appropriate for addressing your question? Unfortunately, the way that it often plays out in academia is people say, I'm not good at math, therefore I'll do qualitative studies. This is sort of journalistic, and as someone, I really, you know, I don't like that. I can't stand it when people say that. I was good at math, and I do work in qualitative studies because I think it's more rigorous in some ways. But so how do students make that decision, and why is it one or the other and not both?
That's a question we considered as a faculty coming from diverse methodologies. Of course, all of us want students in our area. I'm a quantitative scholar, by the way. And so, of course, we talked about that. We wrestled with it as a question. Ultimately, some of it comes down to the number of credits. Our 36-credit model is exactly in tune with every other master's program in communication in the state. We found ourselves adding this class and this class. We were pushing ourselves upward toward mid-40s. And you need to make some decisions. We felt that to offer the students a choice would be fairer than demanding they take one or the other. So I don't care what you like, you have to take this. And then finally, it came down to how do they choose. Some of it will be the faculty member they want to work with. For instance, currently in our faculty, if you want to do interpersonal research, all of our interpersonal researchers are of a quantitative nature. So I imagine, as a student, if I wanted to work with Dr. Kayanis, I would probably take quantitative methods. The same goes for some of our media scholars. Not always, but some of our media scholars are critical cultural, and I imagine they would take qualitative because that's who they want to work with. We're hoping to offer enough option and discussion, like you're saying, you know, you what questions do you ask, who do you want to be, under advisement with your advisor, discussion with your advisor, your thesis person, that they would make an informed decision. But we felt as a faculty it was much better to let them choose which way they'd like to go rather than force them into one or the other. It also fits the talents of our faculty. And ultimately not both. We needed to keep it under 40. Certainly if someone wanted to take both, we could work that in. We could work that in.
Dr. Grossman, then Dr. Tracy.
Hi, Jerry Grossman, Department of Mathematics and Statistics. One substantive question and two numerical clarifications. So there's a new faculty member in year two, and then another new faculty member in year four. And then there's an item that talks about faculty in-load replacements. So that presumably means you'll take some faculty who are currently teaching, say, undergraduate courses and have them teach in the graduate program and then have part-timers teach the courses that they were teaching, which seems to me the trend that we've been decrying for years of more adjunct faculty and less of our credits being delivered by regular faculty. Some of us seem to think that's maybe not such a good idea.
I think that we would agree. Our budget was written under a watchful and conservative eye. It is our choice to, rather than replace faculty, full-time tenure-tracked faculty into the master's program, and then take those classes and give them to part-timers. It's our balance, especially in that first year, to not require any faculty inload. For instance, it's our plan not to hire, it's our desire not to hire any part-timers to replace our faculty, but rather we're trying to manage best we can enrollment in our undergrads. For instance, with our 400 level classes, we're having trouble filling them. And so I'm not sure the undergrads will miss that, and yet that frees up someone to teach. But our budget was done conservatively, understanding that if we had an influx of individuals and needed to offer more and more grad classes, something had to give. And so conservatively, it's in there. I would love not to use that.
Okay. The numerical clarifications, you said in the third year there's a profit, but as I read this sheet, there's a profit already from the first year in terms of the...
Oh, the profit. I believe that if we... are successful in our 25, then we should be profitable from the first year. Under the Senate, I think the quote we saw up there was from the Senate review for the budget area, and they projected probably profitability, comfortable profitability by that third year.
Okay. And then I think you said something about a 50% increase in the headcount.
We're hoping in 5 years.
But I think it's 120% increase. You're going from 25 to
thank you.
55.
Thank you.
But at least it's not in the millions, is it?
Yes, no, thank you. Yes, it wasn't 62 today. Million.
Dr. Ron Tracy?
Yes, Ron Tracy, Department of Economics. Since you said that the norm across other institutions is 36 credits, and at most institutions they offer 3-credit courses, which is 12 courses, what made you choose the 4-credit mode, which limited you really to 9 courses and therefore presumably caused your problems of breadth and trying to be selective? Why didn't you go to the 3-credit model? It's used elsewhere in this university.
I guess it's not, it might not be my experience. Yeah.
No, we have 3-credit courses.
Yeah, School of Business Administration has 3-credit modules.
As I think even education has 3-credit courses, if I'm not mistaken.
So I
I was wrong.
please, those of you who wish to make a comment, use the mic and identify yourself for the sake of recording it. Thank you.
It was my understanding that the 4-credit model didn't differ drastically from what other institutions were offering, as well as what fit into some of Oakland's classes and model.
Ken, Dr. Mitten.
Ken Mitten, Iyer Research Institute. Just a suggestion, and I guess it's probably being considered. I don't know if in the Oakland system if any of the units have special topic fourth-year courses that can be sort of dual-registered. You're a fourth-year student, and it's one number, and you're a graduate student, and it's another number. Is there any way to maybe keep some of these courses in that kind of format and still not have to feel like you're cutting back special topics for your undergrads?
Sure. We've done that. Thank you. With some of our... more enrolled courses, I don't want to say more popular, but some of our more enrolled 400 level classes, we've actually, under the advisement of the Graduate Council, developed the bridge courses, so we can have both master's students taking those courses as well as some of our undergrads. Is our commitment to retaining undergrad offerings was strong. We really feel passionate about keeping our undergrads well prepared for wherever they're going to go, even if it's not our program. And so, yes, thank you. We've actually incorporated some bridge courses, not many, because it's a dangerous pattern to fall into. It can be. And so we've really tried to limit the number, but in order to maintain our offerings to our undergrads, we have done that in some cases. Thank you.
Dr. Jackson.
When Senate Planning reviewed this, I think the only real, not even a criticism, we want them to offer more. Because the area of communications is just a fantastic discipline, and there's just so much that can be offered. We wanted them to step on the toes of the School of Business, and we wanted them to offer organizational communications, and hopefully in the future they'll be able to do that, because as I look at some things that are happening in the business world, we're trying to deal with these X generation and P generation and A and B and C generation people. We don't know how to talk to these students, and they don't know how to talk to us. And you're seeing more and more companies who are hiring communication experts to try and help improve how organizations communicate and talk and what is and is not acceptable. So I think it's a strong program. We strongly supported it on Senate planning. And we just felt that there was so much more that could be offered. And we hope that will be, there will be the foundation for that with enrollment to do that in the future. But it's very exciting discipline.
Thank you.
Dr. Kelly here.
Thank you for that question and comment. We have many more courses that we developed than what you see in this program. And we will be gradually introducing them. We do have OrgCom scholars, and we plan on getting more. And that's why it's interpersonal/organizational. As soon as we have the bodies, we will deliver the courses, because one of mine's on hold, just because there's already too many. At least the Grad Council Committee thought were too many at that given time. But we will definitely be able to deliver more classes and staff them. And the bridge idea is just one way to do that.
Thank you. Dean Julie Volk.
Julie Volk, Dean of the Library. It's about money again. I'm sorry. We want to support this program and do it well. And I understand that you predict comfortable profitability in year three, and it makes it difficult. But I noticed that in your budget, you have budgeted about $6,000 less than what we had asked per year. Mm-hmm. I understand where you got that. You decided to go with some of the things we recommended, but not all. But I would ask you to please reconsider that. It is my experience that with new programs, if we don't get that budget up front, we will never get it. And these are difficult economic times for the library. Thank you.
We actually, I believe, had that question addressed to us in the Senate budget, and our response was that we did. We made some choices and went with less of what you recommended, but if there is a need for that, our department is actually very active at the Macomb University Center and has historically been able to support itself and other needs outside of that Macomb University Center incentive program. And so I believe we responded to the budget planning committee's request was saying that that difference in money could actually be made up from the incentive program. So it's still there, but it's not in writing. Yes, I believe it went back as a recommendation. So we have the money in.
Thank you. Anyone else? Any other comments? Please.
Selkirk Mathematics. Simple curiosity. What are the prerequisites for the program? What bachelor's degree will you accept? Do you accept anybody who comes in? If not, what's your analysis of the students coming in, and how will you pick them?
The admission criteria?
Yes.
Our admission criteria is a completed BA, obviously one from an accredited institution. I believe that we are asking for letters of recommendation from faculty close to that scholar, and as well as we're asking for the graduate assistantship folks take the SAT or the GRE, what would be their equivalent. In addition to that, we're asking for some kind of resume vita application process. In terms of what BA, what degree would we allow in and not, I'm going to leave that in the hands of our graduate committee to make those decisions. Now, obviously, some areas are more closely married to communication than others. For instance, a sociology or an English major obviously seems like a ready-made mix for a communication degree or a communication master's. But that isn't to say that we wouldn't also be interested, or at least I would never turn away on the face of it a mathematics background. We don't know what that person wants from their degree. And obviously, as we consider our students who are interested in retooling themselves and really recreating themselves in the Michigan work environment, I think our program would be open to folks from a variety of areas, as long as they had the supplemental, you know, the good grades, the strong recommendation letters, perhaps the GRE scores to back that up.
Any additional? David Lau.
Just a quick comment here, really to address Jerry's concern about what might happen in terms of replacement faculty. And I wanted to give some assurance that's replacement from the undergraduate program moving into the graduate program, that we have certainly no intention of pulling part-time faculty into our upper divisional core required courses, courses like multicultural communication, communication theory, and our capstone course. We will make sure that that is a quality control concern that doesn't happen. I think if we need to bring in some additional part-time people, we'll work to keep that as a minimum, and that will be in the lower divisional courses.
Thank you. Annette, yes, please.
Annette Osborne, Education. Your graduate assistants, will they be teaching assistants or will they be working for professors?
I believe that, I'm assuming the when there's two. Right now, we don't have a system set up for having our students in the classroom. So our intention is that they would be research assistants, RAs, as opposed to graduate teaching assistants, GTAs.
This was a first reading, and I call on Dean Sudol and the presenter. What you have heard, if you could incorporate that into a very brief presentation next time so we can vote on it.
Sure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's move on to item number three, which is a resolution to support the position of Michigan Association of Campus Law Enforcement Administrators opposing Michigan Senate Bill 747 and House Bill 5474 legislation, which would amend the current laws pertaining to weapons on university-owned property. And Professor Osborne will make the motion.
Move that the Senate endorse a resolution to support the position of the Michigan Association of Campus Law Enforcement Administrators opposing Michigan Senate Bill 747 and House Bill 5474.
Thank you. Professor Jay Meehan, were to make a presentation or
can
brief remarks?
Second?
Here or over
second?
There?
Second.
Mr. Jackson, thank you.
Would you like me here or over there?
Either way is fine.
Jay Meehan, I'm sociology and anthropology in the College of Arts and Sciences. I approached the Senate Steering Committee about supporting this resolution because a couple of meetings ago, Sam Lucido appeared before this body and alerted us to this current bill before the Senate and the House. What I'm passing around is the actual contents of the letter itself from the Michigan Association of Campus Law Enforcement Administrators. And in addition to that, in your packet, I've also included the actual Senate bill, 747, and I'll tell you why I've included that in a moment. And then last but not least, the Senate, the Senate Fiscal Agency did a summary of this, and that's the third item in your packet. So I just wanted to lay that out there for you. I included the actual Senate bill in the packet because I wanted people to see that this particular bill specifically targets university and college campuses for exclusion from the current law, which at the present time, people who have a permit to carry a concealed weapon cannot bring such a weapon, into a building, a residence hall, or a classroom. They may keep it in the parking lot, however. That's an interesting little wrinkle to it, but at least it keeps it out of the classroom, out of the residence halls. And if you look on page 3 of the bill, you could see that the only area where this particular legislation is targeting is a dormitory or classroom of a community college or college or university. Other areas where folks are prohibited from bringing a concealed weapon include places like hospitals, K through 12 schools, daycare centers, sports arenas or stadiums, bars and taverns, places of worship, and the like. And so part of what I'm trying to do is to bring your attention to the idea that this is part of a broader movement to specifically focus on what's going to occur in colleges and universities. Now, some of the folks who are putting this forward will bring up arguments such as, well, if we had guns on campus, we wouldn't have a Virginia Tech. I don't want to go there right now with that. I want to point your attention to what our campus law enforcement administrators are objecting to and the problems that this is going to create for them. Notably, if you look at the third paragraph of the McClia letter, they point out that the police are most concerned about their ability to monitor and regulate the possession of weapons on campus property. One of the most common crimes in our society, let alone on campus here, is larceny theft. The presence of valuable objects, whether it's a computer, a phone, or in this case, a gun, will just raise the probability, the possibility that these will become the next objects of theft. Simple and dangerous larceny from my perspective. The next issue has to do with the fact that I think we all know there is a problem of alcohol and drugs on our campuses in America. Oakland is no exception. Alcohol and arguments lead to terrible consequences. The availability of a lethal weapon is only going to make that matter worse. The immediate availability of a weapon is only going to make that matter worse. This is what the police chiefs are talking about when they say that the problem of monitoring and regulating weapons on campus is really important. Okay? The other issue that they bring up in that third paragraph has to do with the problem that in the unlikely probability of an active shooter on campus, and I'm going to emphasize unlikely, national data show that college campuses are among the safest places to be in this country. In the unlikely probability of an active shooter on campus, the last thing that law enforcement wants to confront is the problem of other people who also have weapons on campus. Not only that, but, and again, that's the unlikely probability. Here's the more likely probability. If weapons are going to be allowed on campus, as this is proposed, if this law passed and this happened, there would probably be more what we would call false alarms on campus, such as like someone sees a student who has a gun and they call the police, and the police are going to respond to this as if there is a person who needs to be investigated, and they're going to approach them as if they're potentially dangerous. So it's going to alter the way we have to, you know, deal with police resources. It's going to lead to encounters, and I didn't put the connection here. There's a YouTube encounter out in Utah between a campus police officer and a student that's long and extended about, you know, whether they have the right to bear arms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that was all triggered by a student seeing this other person carrying a gun. So what I want to do is I want to encourage the Senate to basically support what the Michigan Association of Campus Law Enforcement Administrators is asking, which is to, you know, have the committees in Lansing say no to this particular bill. Okay?
Thank you. This is the first reading, so we'll look at it. If you have additional comments and suggestions, we can discuss them at the next meeting. Let's move on, Jerry, and then Ron Tracy.
Just wondering if there's any sense of urgency as to when this might be arising in the legislature.
No, it's been in committee, it seems, since like December. So I don't know about the sense of urgency. I just know that Sam, in particular, was encouraging us as individuals to write. Our legislators, And what I would like to see is that not only that the Senate endorse this, but as we have with the statement about academic freedom, that something like this goes before our Board of Trustees as well. At the last Board of Trustees meeting, someone did stand up and give a presentation about this law and ask the board to basically support, you know, the change in the law. The board was mute on the subject.
Thank you. Dr. Tracy.
I'd like to move that we waive the second reading.
Second.
All those, any more discussion in waiving the second reading? We need 3/4 again. All those in support of waiving the second reading, on the, please show your hands. Thank you. Those who do not wish to waive, show your hands. One. So motion takes, we waive the second reading. Any more discussion before
we... I just
we
have one question.
Please.
If we support this, we're supporting that concealed weapons cannot be carried on campus. Does that include faculty meetings? Oh, I'm against it.
That is everybody. That's everybody. Everybody. And as a department chair, I really like that rule.
Actually, under the proposed law, faculty still couldn't carry it. It would be students. Right.
No. I think it's still everybody.
I don't think employees at the university can under the law.
If you qualify under the considerations here, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. I'll double check.
Well, let's not test it.
I agree.
Any more triggers on this issue? Hearing none, let's vote on it. All those in favor of the motion presented by. And supported by Jay Meehan, please indicate your approval by saying yes. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. We take it. Move on to number 4, which is a motion from the steering committee to adopt a process of removing a member from the Senate committee. And Ron Tracy will make the motion.
Move that the Senate endorse a resolution. Move that the Senate approve the following policy for the removal of a member of a Senate committee. In the event that a chair of a Senate committee wishes to remove a committee member for inappropriate conduct, he or she must make that request in writing to the Senate Steering Committee via the Senate Secretary. This request should provide a detailed rationale. It is appropriate to include documentation that may substantiate the request. If the majority of the steering committee members agree that the chair's request should be granted, a member of the steering committee will meet with the committee member. At this meeting, the committee member will receive a copy of the chair's request and be given a choice of formal responses. The committee member may resign from the committee. If this option is taken, reference to the removal may not appear in subsequent review letters. The committee member may rebut the charges and request a review of the Senate Steering Committee. In the event that the committee member requests a review, a meeting with the committee member, the chair of the committee, and the Senate Steering Committee will take place. The committee member may request that a university employee be present as an advocate. Witnesses may be invited to help verify the disprove the statements. If witnesses are to be invited, the steering committee must be given sufficient notification that the participants can be informed in advance of any witnesses that will appear. If the steering committee decides that there is insufficient cause for removal, it will inform the committee chair and the committee member in writing. If the committee member agrees that it is appropriate to remove the faculty member, it is authorized to do so and will proceed to fill the vacancy using normal procedures. In the event that the committee member resigns or is removed from the committee, future Senate steering committees may refuse to consider the faculty member for service on Senate committees.
Thank you. Any second?
Second.
Second. Discussion, comments? This is a first reading. Dr. Grossman.
I just wondered what subsequent review letters meant. Are we talking about personnel reviews, C1, C2, et cetera? Is that what is meant by that? I'm just wondering how one enforces the fact that a reference can't appear there because these letters are written by disparate folks around the university.
I think as you think about it, this is not my opinion, just an observation. As we review C1, C2, C4, and professorial review documents, oftentimes a candidate will write his or her service on a committee and use it as a significant contribution to the institution. Occasionally, one will notice that that person actually was mostly absent in these meetings, which is listed as a credit. And I think it addresses that issue, perhaps, among others. This is not the only issue. And if the person is removed, for example, with a due process, that person has then option of not including it as a credit to the committee unless the review committee, department chair, or someone else mentioned that. But you cannot be getting a credit for a committee service in which you didn't contribute. Tom Pedroni.
Tom Pedroni, School of Education and Human Services. I wish that there were some definition present in this of what constituted misconduct or inappropriate, or whatever the terminology is within there. Because it seems also that the steering committee would need some sort of way to measure the seriousness of a grievance. And you know, in faculty governance, obviously, the chairs play an important role. There is a concern about de-democratization. If a chair is empowered in this way, it's an additional piece of leverage, which is fine if there, you know, there are obviously grievances that are very serious, but there are others which, you know, could be much more petty. So some clarification of what constitutes misconduct for me would be helpful.
Dr. Tracy?
I think the reason it was not put down is because it is a list, and we don't want to go and make the list such that we miss something. I think it is saying we are all faculty, we all have been on committees, we know what's petty, and we felt that a steering committee, whoever is on it, who is elected by this body, would show proper restraint. I don't think anybody's intention is to remove people from committees. It's hard enough to get enough people on many committees to be removing them from that. On the other hand, there are times when someone's actions or inactions can actually be detrimental to a committee, and I think that's what was potentially brought to us to think about. I mean, this resulted from a discussion with a chair who has issues. And we didn't go into those at all in any way, shape, or form, but we did recognize a potential issue here. And obviously, we want to have improvements in this motion. Certainly can come from the floor.
Jay?
Yes, building on that, what about just some examples like attendance, their breach of confidentiality, they're slugs, not workers, you know, something like that. maybe some examples would, I mean, because I think Tom's point is right. I mean, this inappropriate conduct is broad. I mean, you know, some people found my tie offensive today.
Jay, I love your tie.
Can I add one case? Not bringing chocolate for the chair. I'm URC chair, so I think that's what the committee should do.
Very appropriate.
Well, I'll second what Ron said. You've just aptly demonstrated why the document before you doesn't have such a definition.
Any additional probing thoughts? If none, this is a first reading. We will work on these. We are now to good and welfare. Any thoughts or comments? Susan Aubrey.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to update the Senate. March 15th was a somewhat historic day for OU because it was the first day of combined fall and winter registration. And the registrar has informed me that there are currently 3,927 students enrolled for fall 2010 and 2,772 students enrolled for winter 2011 classes. And I understand that the registration is going very smoothly.
Thank you. I want to note and compliment our Senate-appointed committees. Many of them are working on different programs, and they had had a busy schedule, but we will consider at the next meeting whether we can continue our work and finish what is presented to the Senate committees. There are three, four programs, and there may be other issues that are within the committees. At the next meeting, we'll decide if we need to have another meeting in May or further. Based on the Senate work must be completed because many programs do need approval of our committees and our Senate, and we'll discuss that at the next meeting. But meanwhile, I want to thank the committees because these are big jobs. You know, they work overtime to make sure that they help our faculty programs. Thank you. Any other comments? Sure. Suba?
Yes. We're having European night tonight. I think yes, and it'll be happening until 8 o'clock, so we really like it when faculty come down and support international organizations. So we have, I actually have a flyer here if anyone's interested, but it's like a list of entertainment that's happening until 8 o'clock tonight.
Thank
and that's
you.
European night.
Any food?
Yeah.
Okay. You may get some people. Yes. Dean Julie Vogue.
This is not about money. This is about March 24th, 2 to 4 p.m. The Senate Library Committee and Kresge Library is pleased to invite all of you to Authors at OU. This is our fifth annual. If you haven't been, please come. I guarantee you will enjoy it. Great people, wonderful research, great food, and two representative faculty members will be talking about their research. And if you can't come for the full 2 hours, come for what you can. And I'll see you there, I hope.
Thank you. Dr. Grossman.
Would it be appropriate for the Senate to offer support and wishes of good luck to the men's basketball team?
Yes, absolutely.
Basketball team.
Do we need to make a motion? Well, I assume we support it. I think they need our support. One thing about the athlete, I wouldn't want to say any more about that, is that they are good students. Our students stand out, I think, 3.2 or above GPA on average. Four of the eight Wilson Award winners, which is the highest student award, were athletes. I think as opposed to some universities where athletes cannot spell their own name, our students are doing very well. So I appreciate Dr. Grossman's thought about them.
I put Oakland on my bracket to beat Kansas.
All right.
Go Grizzlies.
Adjournment motion?
Move we adjourn.
Second? All right, we adjourn. Thank you.